Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. I always enjoy the opportunity to get together with you and have a good conversation ahead. Ted Ross at the controls and Carissa's back at the phones after honeymoon last week. I don't know how long we keep promoting that or
mentioning that. So, yeah, it's to be celebrated.
Yeah, though. I think so. You know, it's a good thing. We'll go, you know, a couple of years or so on that. You know, we'd like to have a variety of conversations here on Connecting Faith, and today we're going to meet someone who has become an involuntary expert on the etiquette of perilous times.
Which seems
like a topic that we can probably relate to.
Yeah, so. Everybody goes through perilous times for sure, and how do you respond?
Yeah. Well, in this case, we're going to find out, and she actually learned along the way, but shared some great insights in a wonderful little book we'll introduce in a moment. I should mention, though, that our guest today, great writer, and you may have the writing bug and would like to give it a try. We are in our, this is the fourth year of our Faith Radio Writers Contest?
Yes, fourth annual, and it's right there on our website, myfaithradio.com. You can submit still, I think. There's a button there still for it.
Through the end of the month. And you can also go on then and read those entries, and you can vote. You can sort of be one of the panel of judges, if you will, and join the Writers Contest. The winners have the opportunity to spend some time with the acquisition editors from Bethany House Baker Publishing. So it's a great opportunity if you really have a passion to write, and it's a good chance to just kind of itch that scratch a little bit.
Yeah, hard to get that FaceTime with publishers, so a wonderful opportunity.
Check it out, myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. All right, speaking of great writers, let me introduce my guest today. Allison Hodgson is a writer, speaker, and a humorist, a popular contributor to the design website Howze.com, which is a lot of fun. And her writing's been featured on Christianity Today's hermeneutics blog and religion news service, and she has published with Baker Publishing and Zondervan. And the book that we're going to reference today is, I'll read you the subtitle. It's A Ridiculous Little Dog, A Family Who Lost Everything, and How They All Found Their Way Home. Allison Hodgson is the author of The Pug List, and she joins us on Connecting Faith. Hi, Allison. Thanks for coming on today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, the opening line of your book starts this way. The day before an arsonist set fire to my house, I had a long list of things to do. Now, that had my attention, and maybe our listeners as well. So maybe just fill us in a little bit about your family and life before the fire.
Well, before the fire, my husband Paul and I, we have three children, Christopher, Lydia, and Eden, and they were, 14, 12, and 7. And, you know, although my husband says life was never normal for us, my son has a variety of disabilities, but other than that, we had, you know, just a normal, busy life of a young family with several kids and a dog, and just all the busyness and worries and delights of quote-unquote normal life. And maybe thought I knew, even though life had already taught me, you never know what each day holds, you can forget that. And so the day before our fire, I did have a long list of things to do, and that's all I was thinking about. And ironically, I'd spent 6 months going through my house. I felt this compulsion to just get my house in order. And so I'd gone through room by room and decluttered and just got rid of things to what I say in the book, to get down to what I thought I couldn't live without. Hmm. And then I found I could live without everything. Hmm.
Which is exactly what happened, right? Because at some time in the middle of the night, somebody came by and actually set fire to your place, right?
Yeah, it was random. We didn't know him, And that's what he would do. He would look for places. And because of all the things I'd been going through, one stall of our garage had things that we were just slowly taking out to throw away. And I inadvertently created a pyre. Like the week before the fire, maybe a couple weeks, I'd gone into the attic and there was a trap door. And so it was stuff that had been there before we owned. And so I just started pitching it through the trap door, and I inadvertently created this pyre. Mm. And I think he drove by our house when my husband was working in the yard and saw, wow, you know. And so he came back and got in to our garage and set that trash on fire.
It really burned the place down, right?
We lost everything. It was a total loss. Some of the house remained and had to be torn down, but we lost everything except the clothes on our backs.
My family got out. I mean, thankfully,
yep.
And it wasn't in the middle of winter, was it?
No, it was in spring, and it was early summer actually, and so it was the temperatures weren't something we had to worry about, but. Mm. Yeah, we lost everything. And I thought, in the beginning, I thought we'd already been through some hard times. And so I really thought it was just about losing our possessions. And so watching our house burn was actually this kind of transcendent spiritual moment for me, because I thought I was just so clear that was just stuff burning, and anything that mattered was my family, and they were alive and they were safe. And I thought, I actually, in the first few days, the first few weeks after our fire, different people, you know, as people checked in, expressed their remorse, I said to some people who had been through some hard times, I said, we've been through worse, you've been through worse. And I didn't know what I was talking about, because it was the beginning, and I didn't understand trauma. I didn't understand a catastrophic insurance claim, and it was the beginning. It was the beginning of our tragedy. Losing everything was just the beginning.
Hmm. You know, I guess we all know, certainly as believers, know and understand that, you know, our lives are of ultimate value. It's not the stuff that we fill up our homes with, and yet it was still stuff, right? I mean, it was still things that were important to you, and as you said, you'd kind of culled it down to the point of things that you didn't think you could live without.
Yeah, it's, you know, it really, it's interesting, because for each one of us, it was different. For my children, much more different, because obviously their relationship with their home, it was their sense of security. It was their precious belongings, especially for Eden, our youngest. But for me, what I wept about, you could probably put in a medium-sized suitcase. You know what? I would just give a lot to have back. But most of it, I don't even give it a second thought. And that's really what I thought. I wasn't proud. I was quiet about it, but I did have this quiet sense, maybe this is spiritual maturity, because in the beginning it didn't hurt. Losing everything didn't hurt. And what really was so devastating and so hard was rebuilding. Mm-hmm. And that was surprising to me. And ultimately it brought, as strange as it sounds, a sense of shame. It's like I felt like in the beginning I had my priorities straight, and then when it just got so hard and painful and all the emotions and aspects of the traumatic response came into play, I was really ashamed of myself, because I just thought, Well, and the world was telling me, you know, once we broke ground, it was over. And I think that was one of the hardest things, was this sense that there was a timeline for our grief, and that the house was going to be a big payoff for the fire. And that just wasn't the way it was.
We'll talk a little bit more about what it was like to actually go through that process with insurance and all that in a few minutes. I do want to ask you, I know, because you say you could summarize what happened in one sentence, but that really didn't represent the breadth and intensity of the impact in your family. Did you find that people wanted to know the story, or did they just say, well, just, you know, tell us your story? I mean, it's kind of dramatic. So our house was burned down by an arsonist.
Well, it was, yeah, it was strange. Like, on one hand, there something I learned is we have this this need to know this can't happen to me. Like, when something terrifying happens to someone you know, it becomes a possibility. And so we, in general, many of us, we just kind of want to cross off, like, have I done the things that could prevent that from happening to me? And so there, we dealt with, from some people, just idle curiosity, like, what caused it? And then also, you know, genuine concern, obvious, and so many people were concerned for us, and, you know, it was incredible kindness. But then there was idle curiosity, and then there was that, how can I keep this from happening to me? And that was hard, you know, and then there was a lack of curiosity. There were, I realized, just assumptions of what we were going through. Like, in the beginning, the assumption was losing everything was devastating. And for me, in the beginning, that wasn't hard. And then once we broke ground and the house we were building was lovely, then there was this sense that, oh, wow, like, the new house is nicer than the old one. Like, wow, you guys are making out. And while the house was lovely, that wasn't the way it was. You know, it was not worth it.
No, life through difficult times. How do we take that journey? We're going to talk more about it with Allison Hodgson. And as the book title suggests, there is a dog in the story, so we're going to get to that. We're talking The Pug List, A Ridiculous Little Dog, A Family Who Lost Everything, and How They All Found Their Way Home. Allison Hodgson's a writer, speaker, and as it says in the book, she has become an involuntary expert on the etiquette of perilous times. I want to just encourage you to stay tuned. By the way, we've got some copies of this great little book. It would be a wonderful summer read. You'll enjoy it. I mean, if there's possibility of enjoying reading a story about someone burning your house down. But actually, it's very well written and a wonderful story. And we got some copies to give away. So if you'd like to sign up for that, we'll do a drawing at the end of the hour. Call us at 877-933-2484. 877-93-FAITH. You don't have to like pugs to you'll enjoy this story, but you'll want to sign up for that. And you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join in as well. More with Allison Hodgson coming up. Talking about hope today. And talking about working through trauma, grief as a family, and how a little dog helped in the healing process, with Allison Hodgson, who's written a wonderful book called The Pug List, A Ridiculous Little Dog, A Family Who Lost Everything, and How They All Found Their Way Home. It's from Zondervan, just came out here not too long ago. Got some copies to give away. Allison's a writer, a speaker, and she's co-founder of Breathe Christian Writers Conference, and lives with her family outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan, joining us today. Allison, I guess I mentioned that, you know, house burned down by an arsonist. Did they ever find the arsonist? You actually ended up being in proximity, as I understand, right?
Yes. As we ran out of the house, these lights, you know, we ran out of the house and we made it to the edge of our property and the power lines started crackling. Fire moves really quickly, and then when there's an accelerant, whoosh, you know. So we knew we had to get across the road, get away as far as we could. And so we're in full on fight or flight, and we're about to run across the road, and, you know, we're fanned out, holding hands, and these lights come up. There was a hill. We live in a crossroads, and we had to stop, and it's almost physically painful to be in this huge adrenaline rush, but you can't get hit by a car after fleeing your house on fire. You can't. So we're paused, and it's just everything in me wants to keep running, running, running. And then the car came to the stop, and we're waiting, waiting, waiting. And then the door opens and the driver kind of staggers out and goes to stand in the middle of the road. And my husband and I just look at each other, and the guy pulls out a camera, his phone, and it looked like he was taking a picture or texting or something. And my husband and I just roll our eyes and we're just like, yeah, go. So we run. Well, I'm on the end and I'm looking at this guy, to be honest, hating him. I just think he's the most clueless person in the world. And, you know, I have no idea there's any foul play. I don't have any ideas at all. You know, I'm just like, run, run, run. So I look at him and we make eye contact and he looks at me and he says, is this your house? And I'm rarely speechless, but I was, you know, and I thought later, you know, I joked about things I could have said to him, like, oh, no, it's the neighbor's house, and we got the kids up to watch, or, you know, and then a couple other, and then one of them was, before we understood it was arson, you know, no, we said it, and we're fleeing the scene. So I just kind of made this nonverbal, just, you know, like, are you kidding me? And then ran. Well, it was only a couple weeks after that, there was another fire. And then a week after that, there was another fire. And not on our side of the town. Ours was the first. And so then they started cluing in. Ours was undetermined. Unofficially, they knew it was arson, but it's kind of hard to prove. And so officially, it was considered undetermined. But then there was a string in this area. And then that's when I remembered this guy. And I thought, the thing that struck me was he didn't try to help. I said to Paul, I said, what that, you know, that guy who stopped at the stop sign, I said, even when you can't help, it's just human nature to just try to help, even if you're actually getting in the way more than you're actually helping, you know, and even if what you're trying to do is ham-fisted, you know, just like, do you need me to call anybody? Do you want to, all five of you and your dog, get in my car, you know, but nothing. And the sheriff came within minutes and he just kind of disappeared. And so I just knew it was him. And so I wrote a description, which was, you know, it's very vague. It was very vague, but when they caught him, he happened to fill it. And he didn't plead to our fire. So, you know, officially we don't know, but I know it was him, yeah. If that makes any sense.
Sure. You maybe just say a word about the practical side of kind of dealing with insurance adjusters and all that. I mean, it became just an ordeal, didn't it?
It's an ordeal. It's a lot of money's on the table. I mean, in most cases, things are gone. So there's a lot of room. I'm going to try and be as fair about this as possible. There's a lot of room for fraud because everything's gone. So you can say what you had, but you kind of have to try. Basically, people say, well, I'm insured for $1 million. And it's like, well, nobody's insured for that. You're insured up to $1 million. And the up to involves months of toil and negotiations, and you really, you're at your very worst, and it's a negotiation. It's a massive negotiation when you have so little to give and to do. So we personally hired something called a public adjuster, and that's someone. It's basically like hiring a realtor to sell your house. Like, sure, you could put a for sale by owner, but you could pay somebody to handle all the hassles and negotiation and paperwork, and that's essentially what we did. And it's still this huge gut-wrenching ordeal. And anybody who's been through a massive insurance claim will tell you it's the rebuilding. It's the starting over that's so hard, more than the loss.
Let's take just a quick sort of time out and talk to Doug, calling in from Rossay, because Doug has a similar experience. So Doug, you got a couple minutes just to share a bit about your story.
Yes. It's been many years ago now, but it was December 1st of 1984 that we had 2:00 in the morning, fire alarm went off, and upstairs we were sleeping. And we got the kids out and called the fire department. They come. We had actually what appeared to be at the start very little damage. They got it out, but so we lost virtually nothing other than some extra sheets and this and that in a cabinet that we had. But I wish now that we would have lost the whole works because it wasn't worth it. All the cleaning and everything else. And we ended up building a new house anyway, but dealing with the insurance and stuff was problems also in that they go for the lowest bidder for cleaning up your house and doing this and doing that. And I don't know how anybody would work as cheap as what some of them bids were.
Well, Doug,
so
I wish
it would have just totally burned down and been done with it.
Yeah. Well, Allison, did you, thanks, Doug, for your story, and sorry about your loss. Allison, did you kind of think, well, this, you know, clean slate, I mean, this could work out okay?
Well, what I like to say is there's no good house fire. I wouldn't wish one on a rat, and it's just you know, I've been through some hard times, but there's just something so unsettling, and you're at such a loss to not have your space, to just be so unsettled, and to be starting from scratch. And in just very pragmatically, as terrible as it is, but just pragmatically, I would say Doug is right, even though it sounds terrible. A total loss is in some ways less complicated, but there is no simple house fire. And fortunately, I mean, they are much more common than what you would think. But, you know, many people are never going to experience that. But I think one of the important things that my book speaks to is just, I think many people have been in a hard and painful time that it took them so long to get through and to endure and to recover from. And just that, you know, you can sprint, you can run fast, you know, but to do a marathon or to be in a triathlon spiritually and mentally and emotionally, that's what's so hard. It's Oswald Chambers talks about the day in, day out of living that's so hard. And I think my book speaks to that when you're stuck in a painful situation that goes on so much longer than you anticipated.
Well, we're going to get to the dog part of the story and talk family and the children and the recovery in just a few minutes. We're talking about the Pug List. We've got some copies of this wonderful book to give away from Allison Hodgson. You can sign up for it, and we'll do the drawing at the end of the hour. It's 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. More with writer, speaker, and humorist Allison Hodgson in just a moment. Allison probably heard that a time or two, and, you know, maybe early on it sounded right, but after weeks and months, maybe not so much. Allison Hodgson's a writer. She's been featured in Christianity Today's Hermeneutics blog and Religion News Service. She's written this wonderful book called The Pug List, published by Zondervan. She's co-founder of Breathe Christian Writers Conference, and as the story is, we've told it about, you know, recovering after an arsonist sets your house on your life on fire. Did you hear people saying this is going to make you stronger? You'll be better because of this. And I'm wondering maybe how you responded to those things and how your children responded.
No, what we heard in the beginning was people were amazed at my response because, like, from the very first day, I mean, I was in shock, but also I just was really clear, or so I thought. And so people were just really astonished by how strong Paul and I seemed to be. And then, you know, the shock wore off, and then we started engaging with insurance, and then the effects of this traumatic experience began to unfold. And I didn't really understand how trauma works, the physiological aspect, that when you think you're in peril, or you are in peril, part of your brain just kind of, it's like a bridge, like a gate shuts, and the experience gets stuck in part of your brain. And it was only when I tried to write about it and that I would immediately write in present tense. And I can handle my tenses, but I couldn't when I wrote about the fire. And that's, I had several people who were aware of trauma and the effects who were very concerned for us. And I began to think there might be something. And then as we all had our various responses of, but in general, we all really struggled with feeling depressed and no energy and angry. I've always, a temper has been something that I've battled my whole life, and the battle was pretty much lost after the fire. It was just, I was so angry. I got so angry so easily, and so we were in a lot of pain, and it was when it had been a while and where the assumption was we were better and we were rebuilding and, you know, the house was obviously beautiful and we'd been so strong and we weren't strong anymore. And that was really painful to go through that and to feel like I had it all together in the beginning and then I didn't. And now on the other side of it, I'm like, it's like being, you know, three steps into a marathon, you know, and I've got my little sash and I'm, you know, I've got my number and I've, you know, I've got my shoes, I'm all clean and I'm strong. And it's like, talk to me at mile 20, you know, talk to me at mile 13. I don't actually run, so it's just a metaphor for me, you know, but I'm like, I'm guessing, you know, I've seen runners run and in the middle, they look pretty haggard, you know, that I don't think this was a good idea, you know, and they chose to do it. You know, I did not choose to run this race. And I think a lot of people can understand that.
Your 7-year-old daughter decided that what would be best was for her to get a dog, right? I mean, you already had a dog, right?
Yeah, we had a big black lab. And we talked about, I fell in love with a pug online. And I slowly twisted my husband's arm. But by the time he agreed, this other pug had found a good home. The week before the fire was when I called to check, you know, just to double check because I didn't see him on the website anymore, a rescue. And so once the house burned down, I was like, oh my, it wasn't meant to be. Okay, it wasn't meant to be. Well, Eden didn't get the telegram. So she had already started saving money to rescue a pug. And, you know, fiffle faffle, who cares about a fire? I want me a pug. And so we're like, no, that's not going to happen. But gently, lovingly, no. And she is a strong personality. And she began what I call in the book, capital R, relentless, capital C campaign. And, you know, just convincing us. And finally, you know, we were weak. And then she was so passionate that my husband said she could earn the money for a pug. And no promises and it would not be until we were in the new house. And even then, we could still say no. And then worst case scenario, she'd have, you know, hundreds of dollars she could do with what she wanted. So she's like, deal. Well, she was writing in this little journal. She didn't know how to spell diary, so she called it her pug list. And it was a spiral notebook, and it had a picture of a pug on it. And so we rebuilt. She's working. She's taking new possessions, you know, like birthday gifts and Christmas gifts. This is a child who's literally lost every single one of her possessions except for the nightshirt she was wearing when she ran out of the house. And she's putting him in this big box for a garage sale she wanted to have to earn money for the pug. And she said to me when I stopped her, since I just spent a lot of money on these various presents, she said, "Mom, I want the pug more than I want the stuff." And she started earning the money, and I still didn't want a second dog. And reading her little pug list, which was her heart on the page, was really what made me realize that this one was important. And, you know, there's lots of things that my kids have wanted and I've said no to, but when I read her little pug list, I knew it was her heart that was on the line. You know, it was, you know, she's like, "I will not give up, and it is worth it, and nothing's going to stop me, and the pug motivates me, and it makes me happy, so I just keep working and working all day long." And I read that, and like page after page, and her little baby scrawl, and hearts, and pictures of puppies, and I just knew this one really mattered. And you know, any of us who were children, you know, we probably have at least one situation where our parents didn't mean to hurt us, but they missed it. They missed something, and it left a mark. And I just knew this one matters. We need to get this girl a pug, even if I really, really, really didn't want a second dog. And that's what's so funny, is sometimes the things we most resist carry what we personally need. So we got this dog, and I write about our misadventures finding Oliver, and he was a little puppy mill. He lived the first 3 years of his life in a tiny little cage outdoors in just deplorable conditions. And he really was the key, and he brought a lot of healing.
Yeah,
and I fought it tooth and nail.
And theoretically, housebroken, and you know, all those things. I mean, and pugs are, reading your book, apparently they are a little maintenance heavy.
Well, yeah, they're prone to, yes and no. I mean, they can be. You just never know. Some are quite easy and don't have health issues. Some do, and they don't have, like, a lab, this natural desire to please. They're companion animals, and they're very jovial. They have this just joy and hilarity to them. But they also can be stubborn little buggers. And then, I mean, just the reality, he was in a cage outdoors for 3 years, so he was not housebroken, and he was a little stud, which doesn't help anything. So we brought him to our new and, you know, shining new house, and he quickly did his damage. He was a little – so it was complicated. He was a lot of work, and that's – you know, that's life. Sometimes the things we need most, they require effort and commitment. But we love, he's sitting here beside me in my study and just snoring. And I could never have imagined how much joy this silly little dog would bring me, what a difference he would bring for me.
Because I think you were assuming you were doing this for your daughter, right? This wasn't for you or for the whole family, right?
Yeah, and I also thought, you know, I thought the fire was going to teach me about God's presence, and I'd been really thinking about, in a very practical and tangible way, what God being Emmanuel, God with us, what that means. And I really thought after the fire that I was going to learn. Going into it, I thought I knew what I was going to learn. And God felt really far away when we were rebuilding. And it was incredibly painful. And then just one of the great humbling of my life is that God, this silly little dog, this not entirely housebroken dog, carried God to me. Brought hope and a lot of healing and a lot of joy. And it doesn't sound very spiritual. It doesn't sound very profound. But God uses the small things, and God uses the weak things of this world. And And we saw that in this.
And one of the, I'm trying to remember the story, but I know there were maybe some Bible stories or verses that that sort of took on new meaning during the season. I don't know if there's anything that kind of comes to mind that maybe it's something you're reading with Eden or in that process, just thinking about, you know, this is the way God sees us or works in our lives.
Well, there were a couple things. One of the things that struck me was in Ecclesiastes where it says a time to tear down and a time to build. And it wasn't until after the fire that I realized it says a time to tear down first. And it really struck me, you know, after our house was half burned down and there was this wreckage. And I write about in the book how bureaucracy and a lot of times when we want to build something in our life, there's things that have to be torn down first. There's things that have to be removed, and it's painful, and it's a lot of work. And the house was, I think, 60 years old, and to tear it down just took like, I think, less than an hour, but to rebuild it, you know, and then to heal took so long. Like, it doesn't take long to destroy things, but to rebuild, to clean up and then rebuild takes so much. So that was one. And then also, Eden, we had read the storybook Bible before the fire. And it was talking about in the Adam and Eve story where, God says, in the Jesus Storybook Bible, it says God's going to return and there'll be no more sorrow. And when I read that to Eden the first time, she said, well, that's not true. And I looked at her and I was kind of surprised. And I said, well, we're in the story. The story's not over. And it was this kind of profound moment for me to realize we are a part of the gospel being lived out. And I think that's what's so painful about life is that our entire life, we're in the middle. We're in the tension and the uncertainty of things, the not yet, and in the pain and in the trouble of this world. And even when we think we know how things are going to turn out, they don't always. And then just the arduous work sometimes we get to do, just being alive and being human together.
We're talking about the Pug List, a ridiculous little dog, a family who lost everything, and how they all found their way home. Written by Allison Hodgson, who's a writer, speaker, humorist, contributes to Christianity Today's hermeneutics blog, has written a number of publications, co-founder of Breathe Christian Writers Conference. By the way, the book, The Pug List, we've got some copies to give away. It's a wonderful little story. I encourage you to sign up for it. We'll do a drawing at the end of the hour. 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. If you love good writing, you love dogs, love kids, it's a great combination. And obviously going through hard times, some good insights there as well. So give us a call, sign up for a copy of the book, or if you have a question or comment you want to join the conversation, you're welcome as well. It's 877-933-2484. More with Allison Hodgson in just a moment. Talking to Allison Hodgson today about her wonderful story called The Pug List, a ridiculous little dog, a family who lost everything, and how they all found their way home. It's a hope, grace, and the healing power of dogs. Allison, I know you dealt with some post-traumatic stress. As you said, you thought you had it all together early on, but as it just sort of went on, your anger, to use an arsonist term, I guess, was smoldering. At what point did you realize that, you know, some grief counseling would really be helpful for you and maybe for your kids as well?
Oh, early on, and the anger was not smoldering; it was raging. It was like, Oh man, it wasn't good. Just picking up my daughter at school, I just wanted to get a sock full of quarters and start thumping them on people's car hoods. To be honest, I know lots of people, even not after a fire, who want to do that. There's nothing like the pickup line at a school, but
which is a whole separate book, I think. If you wrote about the pickup line at school, I mean, you'd.
If you talk about, like, people who live in their own little bubble. But going back to your question, it was pretty early on. The wheels started to fall off pretty early on. But the hard thing was you can't just, just open up the yellow pages and grab a therapist. And something that was so overwhelming is to have five people in need. It was overwhelming. And so we had a couple misfires and then we landed on someone who was really helpful to the children, somewhat helpful to Paul and somewhat helpful to me as well. But I write about how I felt like I was flunking therapy. It took a long time to heal. It took a really long time to heal. And then it wasn't over. And because once we moved back into the house, you know, at first it was just the traumatic stress, dealing with insurance, dealing with the township, trying to help the kids cope, making our biggest financial decisions under duress. People just who build a house will tell you it's so stressful, you make so many mistakes, you go over budget, and they've planned and budgeted for years, you know, and let alone like we're doing it on the fly. But then when we moved back into the house, that was really when we began to deal with the fact that a crime had been committed. We knew about it, but it just was kind of in the back of my head. It was tomorrow's worry, if you will. Well, when we moved in, that's really when we faced it. And as simple as someone pulling into our drive, and we live at a crossroads, so people frequently turn around in our driveway. And I was used to that. I didn't like it. I have young kids. Well, even to this day, it's been years. It still really bothers me. Well, in the first year or so after the fire, if you turned around in my driveway, I would come flying out of my house to let you know it didn't work for me. And odds are it was someone who'd probably donated something to us or written a check, you know, and like they probably thought I was the meanest lady in the world, but I was just hurting. My trust, my very basic sense of security had been stolen. And so just somebody walking onto our property was painful and stressful and upsetting. And so that was just one way. It took a really long time.
Say more about that, because I know you address, you know, living without fear, and the Bible commands that. Have you been able to make some progress in that area, and is there something you could maybe encourage others who are fearful for whatever trauma they might have gone through?
Absolutely. The irony of all ironies is I had actually been a very fearful person, and just for my physical safety, and in that house that an arsonist set on fire, that's when I really, God took away that fear. I began to know God's love in a really profound way, and the fear just went away. And then we had the fire. And so after the fire, I guess I would say what I learned before the fire was for years I'd prayed that the fear would go away, and I kind of would beat myself up with that verse, you know, perfect love casts out all fear. And so I'd think, oh, I must not have God's love. And it didn't occur to me to just every day to be asking God to fill my heart with his love. And this is something that I pray for any fearful situation with my children and for me. I pray that my heart would be so full of God's love there wouldn't be room for fear. And I think the faith, it can be arduous, but it's really simple, and it's asking to receive God's love, asking to receive his grace, and it's transformative. And so that's what, and sometimes you need help. You know, sometimes you need time and you need help. And I think just not being ashamed of our feelings and mourning and giving them to Him. I think the key to everything is living in the reality of our situation. And if you're afraid, odds are there's a good reason, you know, unless you're bound up in anxiety. And then that is what it is. And to be ashamed of it doesn't change. It's just living in the reality, mourning it, which means talking to God about it. And then the other side of it is hoping. And that's looking for His presence in the situation. And He is in it. Sometimes we can't see Him. And for me, that's really what I learned from the fire. I'd already learned the importance of mourning, which is just acknowledging the loss. But the other side of that is to continue to hope, even in the midst of despairing times and suffering, to be looking for God with us in the suffering and pulling us through it.
We got a couple minutes left. One of the parts of the story that, you know, the book sort of ends without a full completion on this part, because the rescue dog who rescued you was diagnosed with cancer, not long after you brought him home. And it's kind of like, well, is there a happy ending to that story?
Oh, I know. It's like, you got to be kidding me. And the entire world turned out and prayed for this dog. Like, people who, like, I had atheists calling people of faith to pray. It's like the entire world said, this little girl cannot lose this dog. And I write about that. And I think the book ends a lot like life is, in the goodness and in, it doesn't mean just because you've gone through something hard that, oh, now you get a free pass. We continue to have joys and suffering. And so with Oliver getting cancer, it was a suffering. It was a hardship. It was really painful. And I'm happy to say, this is a spoiler, he's right here snoring next to me, and he's doing well. But it was, I think it speaks to the reality of life, that just because we suffer, it doesn't mean that we won't have more problems or trials. And it's just knowing, I think suffering can teach us that God is with us and that it's easier to look for Him in other trying times.
And on behalf of all the veterinary clinics, thank you for your generous contributions over the years.
I'm telling you. Between the black lab and this little pugga. Yes. But you know what? Like, they gave us the chemo at cost. I mean, they're so generous to us. But we did rack up a pretty penny in vet bills.
But a wonderful story, and so glad you wrote it, and that you've come through an important season, and it will really offer some hope to many others. So I recommend it to you. It's a wonderful read, Alice, and look forward to more of your writing in the days ahead.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to have gotten to talk to you today.
Allison Hodgson, my guest today, a writer, speaker, a humorist, a contributor to the design website Howze.com, and her writing's been featured on Christianity Today's Hermeneutics blog and Religion News Service. The book, The Pug List, A Ridiculous Little Dog, A Family Who Lost Everything and How They All Found Their Way Home, was published by Zondervan. And recommend it to you. If you missed part of the broadcast today, or want to hear more, or want to pass it on to a friend, maybe know someone that could really benefit from the conversation. We post our interviews online on the Connecting Faith show page, and you can give a listen to it there. And, of course, it's all shareable as well, so you can pass it on to a friend. We'd love to have you do that. Check it out, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about creativity and culture and about beauty and art. I'm looking forward to sharing a conversation with Makoto Fujimura, who is a noted artist, and he will join us tomorrow on Connecting Faith. I hope you'll be here as well. Thanks.